Okay, so it's November 1st, 2017, and as you know, we've been talking about relationships and mindfulness this year, and what I hope to explore with you tonight is what do we do when it isn't working? In other words, when sometimes you can't change what's happening around you, or in particular, when you're trying to repair with someone and you can't repair with them. Repair is really important. Something goes wrong, something goes awry. We want to do what we can to make it better, understandably. And I think about the metaphor of riding a bike, we're constantly correcting, we're tipping. Same way in relationships. If you watch videotape, so my dissertation was on 15-month-olds, and I watched a lot of videotape of 20 mothers and 10 15-month-old boys and 10 15-month-old girls, and how they interacted with each other over a time frame of even just a few seconds. And one of the things that's striking when you watch people, and you can feel it yourself with other people, is how often we're making little adjustments, little repairs, little shifts, little corrections, little explanations, little forms of attunement or rapport. Like right here, noticing that I'm looming above you, I'm trying to give you a little more room. It's normal. And so we need to make these continual repairs. Relationships that can't make repair become very brittle and fragile. They're not resilient, and they become vulnerable to disruption. So repair is really, really important. Now, most repair happens in really subtle ways. Like, you gave me a little smile there or something, like, okay, it's kind of okay. We reassure each other, we do little things. It's very much in the flow. Other times, though, the repair is very conspicuous and significant. We're seeking them to repair with us because we feel wounded or upset or bothered by what happened, or we feel we had an agreement, ranging from something as simple as how to put the cup in the top rack of the dishwasher, up or down, do you put the forks down or up, the important things of living with other people, toilet lid down, toilet lid up, the important things. Other times, so we try to sort it out with them. Flip the other way, we can tell that they feel wronged, or they, it's beyond telling, they bring it to us hard. They tell us, you did something wrong, you did something bad, you should be ashamed of yourself, I didn't like that, I don't ever want to talk with you again. Maybe they cut off contact right there. What do we do then? How do we repair with people who don't want to repair? Have you ever experienced anything like that? I'm dealing with something like that in my life these days. And you can, so then it gets really, really interesting. What do we do right then and there? And as context, as a kind of high bar or standard, I want to read to you a very dramatic simile or metaphor that comes down to us 2,500 years from the early teachings of the Buddha. This is a really neat book. It's a summary of the discourses or sutras in the earliest surviving written record of the teachings of the Buddha, and also his contemporaries, the people that he trained and lived with and worked with. And this is a particular collection of translations from a really good translator, Bhikkhu Bodhi. And unlike many early teachings, which are early translations, which seem really, really obscure, these are very clear translations. So I think Lily's trying to repair something. Good luck with that, Lily. Yeah, you just, yeah, oh well. You know, that's a line I think somebody mentioned. You're driving in traffic and you're grumbling away, stuck in rush hour traffic. All these other people, all these other people, traffic. And then you realize to them, you're traffic. Right? Oh, okay. So anyway, so basically the context is monastics, at that time monks, women were brought in a little bit later. We'd go out with alms bowls in a very humble sort of way, and different things would happen, including villagers or people who followed a different teacher 2,500 years ago would be critical or do really nasty things like throw clods of dirt or the excrement of various animals. And sometimes the monastics, the monks, often young men, a little fiery, would come back and complain about the way they were treated. And so this is a teaching that was offered to them, I think from Sariputta, one of the Buddha's main students, or you could say disciples. So Sariputta says, monks, and it's generalized potentially to the rest of us, even if bandits were to sever you savagely, limb by limb, with a two-handled saw. This is called the simile of the saw. Trigger alert, that's as far as it goes. So just far away, just down. Monks, even if bandits were to sever you savagely, limb by limb, with a two-handled saw, one who gave rise to a mind of hate toward them would not be carrying out my teaching. One who gave rise, so it's volitional. Things come up in the mind. Things do arise. But if we join with them and fuel them and exercise volition ourselves, there's a critical difference between stuff that arises versus the stuff that we deliberately, really get into. You know the difference, right? That's a critically important distinction that's present in the early teachings of Buddhism, this distinction between sort of automaticity and empty ritual compared to intentional, deliberate, volitional action. That's where we're responsible. And therefore, that's also where we have agency, we have influence, we have power. There's something we can do in our own mind. Even if we notice right now that in the last minute or two we have been giving rise to a mind of hate, we don't have to keep doing it. Or even if in the mind there's a kind of habit or momentum, often that will happen. It has a life of its own. It seems it's still running a bit. Maybe in the body, the stress hormones, cortisol, adrenaline, are not yet fully metabolized. The heart is still pounding. That has a momentum to it. And yet, if we no longer actively fuel it and feed it, that makes all the difference in the world. That's a profound distinction and a very hopeful one for ourselves, and ones that we can look for in other people and invite in other people. In other words, from now on, are we adding fuel to the fire? From now on, three of the most hopeful words in the language. Is that other person adding fuel to the fire or not? Or not? Maybe they're trying to back away from the chalupa or back away from the fire itself. That's the key distinction. So one who gives rise to a mind of hate toward these bandits, even in the most extreme of circumstances, which then creates a kind of standard for more ordinary, still often really awful, but more ordinary provocations, one would not be carrying out my teachings. Here, you should train. So we're training toward this way of being. Here you should train thus. Our minds will remain unaffected, and we shall utter no evil words. We shall abide compassionate for those who wrong us. We shall abide compassionate for their welfare with a mind of loving kindness without inner hate. I don't know about you, let's take a moment to just feel what that would be like. Our minds will remain unaffected in the core, and we'll utter no evil words, and we'll abide compassionate for their welfare with a mind of loving kindness without inner hate. To me, there's a feeling of freedom and peacefulness in that. And the Buddha does not say, give them a moral pass. He does not say, don't call the police or the equivalent of the time. We can recognize injustice. In the teaching here, there's a recognition that these are bandits who are savage. There's a recognition of what's the case. But the mind need not be poisoned, need not go over to the dark side, as it were. to be full of hate. We shall abide pervading them with a mind imbued with loving kindness. And starting with them, these bandits, we shall abide pervading the all-encompassing world with a mind imbued with loving kindness. Abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility and without ill will. That is how you should train. Wow. It's a pretty high bar, isn't it? And yet, in this as well, there's a recognition of a progressive process of training, a progressive process of disengaging from and a falling away of tendencies. That's very hopeful, too. It's a progressive process. Imbued with loving kindness, and then from the people who provoke us, including the people who will not repair with us, we use that for our practice. And we move from them to more generally, without limitation, immeasurable, without distinction, radiating outward from there, without hostility and without ill will. You get a feeling for that. And then imagine, if we can, and then I'll open it up for discussion in a moment, applying this feeling and this stance, including what I think is really central to it, a kind of freedom, and we're doing it for ourselves, because it's more peaceful this way. We're more at ease this way. We feel fed by love as it arises in us. We disengage from, we drop the hot coal of ill will or hostility. We like this. We like this way of being. Imagine applying this now to people you would love to repair with. You maybe would love to get them to shift, or maybe flip the other way. You would love to restore harmony in your relationship, including perhaps through acknowledging your own part in the matter or trying to sort it out, and they just won't do it with you. They will not mend what has been torn. Wow, so you can imagine applying to them. I'm thinking right now of some fairly close to me people who will not repair with me in my larger family system. What's it like to orient to them with the qualities of mind and heart that the Buddha is talking about here? So I want to call out a couple, for me, experiential milestones or touchstones, and then open it up here. One is to accept the helplessness and face it of not being able to make people repair who won't repair. Including the helplessness of the desire to make amends, to express remorse, to apologize, or to explain that they misunderstood something really, really important, or whatever it might be, that there's a helplessness sometimes about it. To accept that. That's one of the hardest things, I think, to deal with, when just to face our helplessness and to find a way to live with it, accept it, see it, be at peace with it. They just won't repair. I think a second touchstone is to tell the truth to ourselves about everything that happened. It's the truth that sets us free, again and again and again. And part of the truth is to sort out what your part was, what their part was, what the other factors were. A truth-telling. And I find that if we're not at peace about something, that's very often a sign that there's some level of truth-telling that hasn't yet occurred. If only to oneself. The truth of what it really felt like, or the truth of the problematic or nasty or badly intended stuff that crept into your own behavior. that piece of the truth perhaps. Maybe the truth about how you realize, wow, it was such a small thing I did, but it was like went right through some chink in their armor and really zapped them. That's why they had that big reaction to it. Something, you know, there's a truth telling. So that's the second touchstone. And then the third one I'll finish on is to see if one can, as the Buddha teaches, and I think really all the great saints and sages teach, is to, as best we can, step out of the parts and rest more and more in the whole. And to see that teaching in so many different kinds of ways, expressed through so many traditions. In other words, there's the part of me and you. Maybe there's the part of the other key players in the maybe family system or in the society. And when we're fixated on parts, which are real in some sense, yeah, I'm here, you're there, we have different social security numbers and a few other things probably. But when we are fixated in parts, including our position, our view, distinct from their view, then it's really easy to move into a wrangle. But if we start relaxing out into, wow, this is humans as a whole, this is the whole of so many causes and conditions that led to what happened, this is physical, material reality altogether, wholeness altogether, which has all these momentary, partial modifications of it locally, and yet really it's one vast fabric, one vast tapestry. Anyway, to the extent you can pop out maybe the bird's eye view, the 10,000 foot view, sometimes it helps me actually to just be realistic that family discord is really, really prevalent. It's part of the human condition. Misunderstandings, woundings, not to diminish them or justify them or use that in any way, shape, or form as an argument not to be as moral as one can, but to kind of get our common humanity, the big picture. And as we go out into the big picture, including the big picture of ultimate reality, we feel less upset by what can't be repaired. Cannot be repaired. Okay. So I invite you to talk about this, and I don't have all the answers, that's for sure. Maybe there are other answers in the room. Yeah, please.
This is not exactly the same relationship, but I can't help but think of Trump.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And would the Buddha accept that we would form a peaceful march?
The question is, do I think the Buddha would accept a peaceful march?
As being acceptable and kind, but still doing something.
Well, if I follow you right, I mean, many people ask these questions, right? So if I don't want to presume in any way to be an expert on what the Buddha would do, et cetera, right? But what we do have are lots of examples of what he himself did or students of his did that were really quite remarkable. And one of them was to first is to recognize that in parallel to whatever is happening in communities and in societies, in parallel to that, people are responsible for their personal practice. Do you follow me? In other words, even in the worst, in the best government, in the worst government, the best civil society, the worst society, individuals are still responsible for how they react to all that and how they practice with their own minds. That would, I think, be a teaching of his. And the second thing related to that, besides responsibility, is freedom. No matter what they do, we can still practice in our minds. And I think there are many examples in the Buddhist stream of individuals sustaining their own practice in prison, being tortured, being mistreated, the body is in pain and the body may react and freak out, but as much as one can, the mind retains a fundamental freedom in relationship to what's happening. So I think that's the first thing. There's an emphasis there. And it's not either or. The second thing the Buddha was very clear about, and there are many examples of it, I could read to you many passages where he has much advice for how to be an ethical ruler, how to be an ethical householder. This is in an agrarian culture 2,500 years ago in which terrible things such as slavery were routinely just accepted as part of a condition. But even there, the Buddha would talk about treating others well. So there was definitely an emphasis on what we today might call social justice. So that, to me, is really clear. And then the last thing I would just say, wow, there are so many examples going back 2,500 years and since of speaking truth to power. At great personal risk, there are stories of monks being called on the carpet by kings who could have had them killed on the spot. And the monks essentially were saying, you have authority, and there is a truth that transcends your power. You don't have the power to change what is actually true, that everything is impermanent, that everything is intertwined, and that we all inherit, we all reap what we sow. We all inherit the consequences of our actions. And right on the spot, there are historically important stories of kings being converted on the spot and getting really interested in this, including the character and the courage of someone who could speak truth in that way. So today, maybe we speak truth in a variety of ways. We speak truth in a march. We speak truth in how we support different causes. We speak truth in how we speak up to other people or confront them. That's certainly consistent.
As long as it's peaceful.
In the Buddhist teachings, there's a strong emphasis on nonviolence, on non-harming, not killing, certainly. There's a very strong emphasis on not striking, not hitting. On the other hand, this is very tricky territory. I mean, you see for yourself what is appropriate to do. I've also, I'll just finish maybe because this is really a minefield to get into. Suzuki Roshi, a great Zen teacher, really profound. Reading summaries of his talks, mind-blowing to me. I talk with friends about these transcripts of his talks and I just go, what? I mean, in a paragraph, so much profundity there. He said sometimes all the precepts, the five precepts, don't kill, don't steal, don't abuse sexuality, don't speak falsely, don't get intoxicated. Those five, he said, sometimes to truly practice, you have to violate all five precepts. And then it gets really tricky with that. So, but that said, how can I put it? I'll just be quite frank here. My moral position is what it is. I myself very genuinely, authentically, routinely, I feel such compassion for Trump. I do. My wife says, what's wrong with you, Rick? But I do. It doesn't mean I am not acting in the ways that I am and not taking stance in the ways that I have. But I don't know. I mean, I find that's kind of a test in a funny way. For other people, I've given talks at Spirit Rock. Can you have, back in the day, compassion for Dick Cheney? That's for a lot of people. That's a bridge too far. So, you know, so you find yourself. And again, I want to be clear. I'm not trying to tell you what to do. I'm just saying that it can be really interesting, again, going back to the saw, if the teaching is to find loving kindness and compassion while recognizing that other people are doing something really wrong and to hold both those in your mind. To me, that's what we're called to. And I noticed for myself, I'll finish on this, that if rancor and hostility has invaded my mind, bad enough he's got my White House. Why add to that letting him have my mind? And you could apply that to just about anything. Okay, yeah.
Hi there. I wanted to ask you about the third touchstone that you talked about.
Yeah.
The ability to kind of look around and resist the urge to split things into parts and make things into a whole. And of course, For me personally, that has always been a very therapeutic practice, no matter what the backdrop. Yeah. But easier said than done. And so I'm wondering if you or anyone else can speak about what types of mechanisms to utilize so as to make a whole lot of particular parts, especially for me in my personal world, where I feel like I'm required to categorize and make parts every single day.
Yeah.
And of course, I do feel inner peace when I'm able to take, I call it a Google Maps zoom out, and I just go all the way out.
Yeah.
But it's particularly difficult to find what mechanisms to use to bring myself there sometimes.
Yeah, definitely. I checked my watch just to make sure that we have time, because I'm losing my sense of time, and we have plenty of time, so it's really good. Well, it's a great thing. So I will offer a few practical things that in part go to the neurology that we have, which is kind of cool, all right? So you're right that so much of what we are trained to do in modern schooling and culture is analytic. It's to break things into parts and then manipulate them well. And a lot of fantastic helpfulness has been the result of that in technology, modern medicine, various kinds, on the one hand. On the other hand, that can take us into a place where we feel fragmented. And it's interesting that the root of the word for mindfulness in the language of early Buddhism, Pali, is memory. In other words, mindfulness is about being recollected, collected, together, gathered together, rather than fragmented apart, moment by moment by moment. It's a really cool way to understand mindfulness in a deep sense. So one of the ways into that neurologically is to disengage from the very familiar, for most people on the left side of the brain, sequential processing, part by part by part, word by word by word, step by step by step, linearity of the left hemisphere. Now that's why fine motor control, which has the foundation of a lot of executive planning and language, are rooted in the left hemisphere, which is specialized for sequential processing. And our hunter-gatherer ancestors had many opportunities throughout the flow of their day living in nature in a rhythmic way, without texting, without being bombarded, without having a lot of intense sequential tasks, a lot of routine and familiarity in their life. There was a natural balancing. But these days, we're doing linearity on speed, part by part by part by part by part. And since neurons that fire together wire together, we strengthen those habits and that circuitry, and then we start to live entirely there. It's a little as if Mother Nature endowed us all with a vast mansion. Except through training, we start to occupy just one room, the computer control center in the penthouse suite. And then all right? And it's pretty cool what's there. A lot of things you can do there, and yet you have this internal sense that we've kind of lost touch with the whole of ourselves. So for me, part of the opportunity is to reoccupy Wall Street, is to occupy our own minds, to reoccupy our own bodies in the fullest sense of it, and reoccupy our whole nervous system and reclaim it. So one way into that is to engage more of the right hemisphere of the brain, and this laterality is reversed for about half of all left-handed people, right? But the principle is the same, generally speaking. In other words, to look for things where you relate to things as a gestalt, as a whole, rather than part by part by part. So right now you can look at this room and you can get a sense of your gaze moving from part to part to part, or kind of get a gestalt, a visual of the room as a whole, right hemisphere, right there. Or do other sorts of things where you're tuning into your body as a whole. All right, so instead of, for example, as you're mindful of breathing, to have attention skitter from part to part to part, see if you can get a sense of sitting, standing, being a body as a whole, breathing. You could do it even right now. It can be actually hard to sustain that gestalt sense of the whole body because we're so trained to be linear, but with a little bit of practice, you can go there. And when you do that, interestingly, neurologically, in addition to the distinction between the left hemisphere and the right hemisphere, you start stepping out of these midline networks, including the default mode network where people space out, tune out, go into daydreaming, worry, ruminate, anxious, self-critical, resentful, whatnot, or more in the front, that's about solving problems, boom, 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 boom. But when you're doing that, there's a lot of stressing in that, and there's a lot of self, me, myself, and I. When you do what I'm describing, when you go out to the whole, when you take things as a gestalt, and you come into the present, letting go of the past, letting go of the future, just right now, you activate networks on the sides of your brain, mainly on the right side for most people, because that's the part of the brain that's specialized for gestalt processing. And as you go out into the whole, to this, these lateral networks, you start seeing the world more holistically. It's a really, really useful thing to train in, particularly to compensate for the routine training we're getting in our work, in our schooling often, to do things sequentially. And then one little detail just to finish on that, that I find really cool, is to it's to really get the truth that everything is a local expression of allness. And you'll find your own languaging for that. There's a friend of mine, Jamal Yogis, occasionally guest teaches here. He wrote a great book, Saltwater Buddha, one of the best introductory books I know on Buddhism. He was as a 16-year-old, he stole his mother's credit card and bought a one-way ticket to Hawaii because he wanted to learn to surf. And then he goes from there and ultimately gets a master's from Columbia in journalism, and he's a great writer and a cool guy and a serious surfer still. Anyway, his most recent book is called, I think, All Our Waves Are Water. So the wave, the part, has a distinctiveness to it, and yet its nature is water. All our waves are water. And you can start to get more and more of a feeling for that with repetition again and again and again, so that it starts getting very alive for you that the boundaries or distinctions between your mind and another person's mind are real in some way, but at a deeper level, it's all one mind sphere, it's all one culture, right? And you get a sense that your body, more and more, you realize, whoa, it's kind of continuous with physical reality altogether. And with practice, you have more and more sense of that. You try to make sure you don't walk in front of a red light, you know, a raging bull or a truck or something like that. But more and more, you really have that sense. And then really last on that, there's plausible research increasingly on what's happening when people in the brain when people are having oneness experiences. In Zen in particular, Satori or Kensho. And one of the notions is that in the thalamus of the brain, there's a switching back and forth several times a minute between a kind of self-referential perspective and a more impersonal oneness perspective. That's a natural process. And the oneness perspective is more ancient, neurologically and evolution. And you can just get a sense of it. It's the sense of I and self is actually a recent development. It aids survival because when you take life personally, you're going to be more motivated to do whatever it takes to live to see the sunrise. On the other hand, it can create a lot of suffering. So question is, how can we, and both modes of relating and perceiving are useful, self-referential, egocentric, quote unquote, or more impersonal, allocentric is the term. Both are useful, but our very social life and our culture really tends to emphasize that egocentric perspective. Speaking of our current president. And what you can do if you want to train in this is to strengthen that more impersonal, oneness, allocentric perspective. And there are a couple things that do that. One is tranquility, because as we become more tranquil, we tend to take things less personally, and that supports the activity of neurotransmitter systems, GABA, which are very relaxing and calming, that regulate this little switch deep in the brain that flips back and forth between taking things personally and not taking things so personally. So train in tranquility. And it's interesting that in Buddhism, on the seven factors of awakening, one of them is tranquility. Real emphasis on tranquility. Not apathy, not suppression, but a genuine stillness and finding that sense of stillness amidst it all. That's good training. And then the other training is to live as much as you can at the front edge of now. In other words, the sense of surprise and delight and newness continuously activates this allocentric perspective. Because the first moment, the first half second in the windshield of consciousness is just something's happened, something's happened, something's happened. We're alerted, we're alerted, we're alerted. And neurologically, that sense of being alerted right in the now, right at the front edge of now, continuously. Again, something that great teachers endlessly talk about. Why do they do that? Well, now we're starting to understand more the machinery that helps us be so useful. As you train in that quality of just being in the present, just present, front end, front end, front end. You're here with what's happening, but you're not trying to fix it or change it or something. It's not the only way to be, right? But that way of being, which is actually neurologically more ancient, just like animals, especially with simpler nervous systems, are just right here, right now, because right at the front edge of now, that alerting and receiving of the moment without trying to fix it or language it or categorize it or understand it or self it, that alerting process is very entwined with, neurologically, these systems that help us have a oneness perspective. Pretty neat, huh? And meanwhile, you can still function, you can still do emails, you can still da-da. Yeah. Pretty good. Okay. Yeah.
Well, I love it for talking about this because I had a recent example where a friend sort of decided that we didn't want to be friends anymore. And I was hurt and it felt unjust. Like, I'm not the only one here. And my first reaction was like, okay, fine. Like, I'm going to unfriend you. We don't have to have any contact. We'll just pretend it didn't happen. Yeah. And I could feel that sort of a sense of like defendedness. And I realized it felt imprisoned. Mm. And once I could sort of feel like whatever my intention was, it was having a negative impact because based on her own mind flow in life.
Yeah.
And I didn't want her to be unhappy if it was my fault or not. And so it was interesting. I sort of sent her, like, I'm always here if you change your mind. Mm-hmm. And it gave me such a great sense of freedom. Like, in the past, I would have felt so, like, a sucker. Like, oh, I'm still here, but you don't want me. And it was so...
Little thought balloon.
Yeah, exactly.
Screw you.
And it was such a freeing sense of...
Yeah.
There's a lot of space here. And yeah. I have compassion that it doesn't work for you.
Well, thank you very much for sharing that, including one of the words you used that really popped out for me was prison. Stepping out of the prison, of being coupled to, in some sense, tied to what the other people do. And to build on what you're saying, for me, the visual of being connected to others with a steel bar. So if they twitch, we twitch too. They go left, we have to go left. You can just feel that. And people are locked in with each other. And it's so wonderful to gradually turn that steel bar into more like a bungee cord. And it gets looser and looser, and then there's more and more of a freedom that they're doing what they're doing. And we have a stillness, in a sense, over here that's not changed by what they do. Yeah, anyway. Thanks. Great. How about the last person?
I just But when that happens, I think that what you feel is you feel that you don't belong for that second, right? And that's what makes you feel that reaction of feeling like something is really wrong, that this is not okay. But what, the reality is that when that bungee cord gets loosened, or the prison bars, that's because the feeling inside is the one that says, actually, I do belong. it's not just about me, this belonging, it's about them too. And so it's not, this is the reason why the
very good, thank you. How about we just sit for a minute, finish it up? Great. Actually, if you'll indulge me, I'll just read this last, I'll read this again. Okay. Drawn into the Buddha's mind stream. Okay. So, our minds will remain unaffected, and we shall utter no evil words. We shall abide compassionate for their welfare with a mind of loving kindness without inner hate. We shall abide pervading them with a mind imbued with loving kindness. And starting with them, we shall abide pervading the all-encompassing world with a mind imbued with loving kindness, abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility, and without ill will. That is how you should train. So let's sit for a minute. Seems like a fitting soundtrack.
You're just having a good time.
That's right. Celebration. Thank you, thank you, thank you.
Thank you.